covers all different kinds of discrimination and harassment. The sex and gender reassignment bit is only one little bit. And at the moment, there is guidance which is out of date and unlawful, which is still being pointed at as being the statutory guidance. So what Bridget should do is revoke that old guidance. She could do it today, she could do it without any delay, and then lay this new guidance in front of Parliament. It needs to sit there for 40 days in order to be agreed. Okay. And that will help businesses of all sizes, service users, people who are trans, okay, and people who are not, to know what are the legal expectations and what rules they, how they should follow the rules.
Maya Forstetter, founder of the group Sex Matters, thank you very much indeed for joining me and explaining that view. Don't miss the Times Radio gender debate tomorrow night with Joe Coburn, who will be hosting us, exploring this entire issue at greater length. In the meantime, thank you very much for being with me this week. Aisha Azarika is here from 1pm tomorrow. My producer today was Chris Eastwood. Maxie Allen did it on other days. And Ryan Boyden was pressing the buttons on all the days. And on the Times at 1 next week, it's Joe Coburn. Now, Fee Glover and Jane Garvey on Times Radio.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Good afternoon, 2 o'clock. This is Times Radio, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you until four.
And in those 2 hours this afternoon, the COVID inquiry will report back on the decisions that were taken or not during the pandemic. Our political leaders are in the firing line. We'll hear from the Sunday Times investigations team about what we can expect. A city in the Saudi desert that's 500 metres high and almost 200 kilometres long. Perhaps it's no surprise that everything went wrong for the line, but we'll look into just how that happened. Our big guest after 3:30 is the comedian and Virgin Radio presenter Tom Allen. And if you've ever looked at modern art and sniffed that your eight-year-old could do it, well, a new study is offering you some vindication on that point of view.
Yes, a load of Jackson Pollock for you a little bit later. Let's start with the news. Here's Tom Noonan.
Thank you. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary has laid out plans to double the length of time legal migrants need to wait to apply for settled status. The baseline will now be 10 rather than 5 years. However, Shabana Mahmood says there will be consultation on making that wait longer in certain cases.
The government proposes that those who have received benefits for less than 12 months would not qualify for settlement until 15 years after arrival. For those who have claimed benefits for more than 12 months, that would rise to 20 years. To encourage the use of legal routes into this country, those who arrive illegally could see settlement take up to 30 years.
There are proposals for some people not to wait a decade, though. For example, teachers and NHS doctors and nurses will still wait 5 years, and those earning more than £125,000 could qualify for permanent status after 3 years. One of the UK's most notorious sex offenders has been given a 37th life sentence. Former police officer David Carrick has been found guilty of two new cases, one in which he molested a 12-year-old girl in the 1980s when he was 14, and another in which he raped and abused his partner once he was an officer. He's already in prison for 71 other sexual crimes, but police and crime commentator Danny Shaw believes there'll be other women he's assaulted.
There's a 10 or 11-year period before he joins the Met. And you think to yourself, well, was he not abusing anyone? Was he not carrying out any sexual violence against anyone? So there's sort of a decade, a missing decade. I think it would be extraordinary to think that there weren't more victims out there. Whether they come forward as a result of this publicity, we'll have to wait and see.
It's reported the Prime Minister's planning to make a trip to China in the new year. It's believed that Sir Keir Starmer will make the journey at the end of January. Ministers have insisted they are not delaying guidance on transgender people's access to same-sex spaces. The Times has been given new guidance which could see trans people banned based on what they look like. Bridget Phillipson, the Minister for Women and Equalities, was given it 3 months ago but has still not published those rules. Barrister Robin Moira White is the first transgender woman to transition while at the bar. She's told Times Radio there will eventually be a U-turn.
The reason we have the Gender Recognition Act is that the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg said that a state has to have a proper means of acknowledging someone's gender transition. And the effect of the Supreme Court judgment is that we're no longer compliant with our obligations. So when that gets to Strasbourg, then I see every prospect of this decision being overturned.
The COVID inquiry will release its second report this afternoon, focusing on decision-making in Boris Johnson's government. Former ministers, including the former Prime Minister, were questioned over how they decided on policies like lockdown, social distancing and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. And Asda is selling off some of its supermarkets in order to raise money. 24 stores have been bought by two sellers. Asda will now lease them back, so they'll continue operating as normal. For a news bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Hello, good afternoon. Hope you're fit and well this Thursday. Jane Garvey and Fee Glover with you in the warm. In fact, I'll be honest with you, it's baking in here. We're here until 4 o'clock. We've turned it down, haven't we, the temperature. I don't know whether Danny Finkelstein suffers from the cold, but goodness me, it's so hot in here.
I think it's just the level of intellectual debate was very, very hot.
Right, OK. Well, we'll certainly bring the temperature
down
in that respect. We're here until four. Please do take part if you're willing and able. It's 0333 003 2353. That's the WhatsApp. Important stuff today, actually. The latest report from the COVID inquiry is published at 4 o'clock. It's going to focus on government decision-making during the pandemic, and that will be our first topic of conversation this afternoon. A peace plan for Ukraine cooked up by the USA and Russia. What could possibly go wrong? President Zelensky is meeting US Army officials in Kyiv today. What is it like to be married to RFK Jr.? Well, the actress Cheryl Hines has been talking to the Times magazine. Also in the Times mag this weekend, you can hear from the brilliant actor Joseph Fiennes. And there's an article about how boyfriends are very unfashionable. Jane Mulcairns has contributed to that. And indeed, she'll talk to us about what's in the Times mag before 3 o'clock this afternoon. Looking forward to that already. Putting HS2 in the shade, the failure of the uber-ambitious Saudi NEOM project. And Jackson Pollock discuss. Anyone could do it. My three-year-old could do that. It's just splodges. Well, what are we all missing? Apparently, it's the sheer physicality of the great man's work. And we also discuss why children just find it easier to recreate because their bodies are more supple, more likely to move in a Pollock-esque manner. That's a little later in the programme. And our big guest is probably Bromley's greatest gift to the world. It is, Fee?
Tom Allen. So you'll know Tom as a comedian, and he is part of This Empire. He broadcasts from the Tower of Power, Virgin Radio's on Sundays. You can see him on the Great British Bake Off Extra Slice. And he's a very keen gardener, and he took to gardening after the quite sudden death of his dad, who had also been a very keen gardener. He found a connection to his father through the garden, and he has loved it ever since. So he's going to come and tell us all about his hydrangeas, which he is particularly keen on. I've watched YouTube videos of Tom Allen and his hydrangeas, and there's definitely something going on there. Well, he just tends them very carefully. And if you treat a hydrangea with care, then every season it's bountiful for you in some shape or form. So he's on after 3:30. Maybe you could send in some gardening tips if you'd like him to answer them. We're 0333 003 2353.
A gardener's question time kind of thing. Has anybody ever done that sort of thing before?
No, but you're onto something, sister.
I think I might have another great idea from the Garvey stable of fantastic notions. 0333 003 2353 is the WhatsApp. Let's have a quick look at the most read stories on the Times website before we talk about the COVID inquiry in more detail. At number three, Steve Smith launches bizarre attack on Monty Panesar on the eve of the Ashes. The stand-in Aussie cricket captain has criticised Monty's appearance back in 2019 on Mastermind, after Panesar suggested a way England could throw Australia off their game. Yes, the sledging has already started in the Ashes. I confess I didn't know that Monty Panesar had been on Mastermind, but apparently he didn't do at all well. The second most read story is She Learns, She Grows, Meghan Markle is making my generation cringe. That's the view of Charlie Gowns Eglinton, who says a new trailer by the Duchess of Sussex sums up why people just can't stand her age group. And the most read piece on the Times website right now, Patagonia blizzard survivor, our holiday turned into a horror film. This is a friend of the British woman who died while hiking in Chile, who said that park rangers had abandoned a refuge without telling them.
Now, the video alongside that piece is really shocking. It is worth a look if you can stomach it, but I have to tell you, it is shocking. You can read all of these articles on thetimes.com. You will need your digital subscription, and if you don't have one, go on, get one. Go to thetimes.com/subscribe.
That takes us to 8 minutes past two. The COVID inquiry publishes its second report today, examining the political decisions that shaped Britain's response to the pandemic. Let's listen back first to some of the inquiry's most significant moments. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister at the time, apologised.
Can I just say how glad I am to be at this inquiry and how sorry I am for the pain and the loss and the suffering, that I understand the feelings of these victims and their families, and I am deeply sorry for the pain and the loss and the suffering of those victims.
Well, you can hear some discontent in the background there. He admitted that mistakes were made.
So many people suffered, so many people lost their lives. Inevitably, in the course of trying to handle a very, very difficult pandemic in which we had to balance appalling harms on either side of the decision, we may have made mistakes.
Well, Dominic Cummings, his advisor at the time, set out Boris Johnson's thought process as the crisis had unfolded.
The PM at the time would refer to the Mayor of Jaws from the film, who wanted to keep the beaches open. I think he had a routine from previous in his career where he would use that as a joke from one of his sort of after dinner speeches. But he sort of said, you know, there's more harm coming. The mayor was right all along to keep the beaches open, because it would have been a long term harm to the community.
Well, that's Dominic Cummings. Also in the inquiry, a senior medic broke down in tears whilst describing the scenes on intensive care wards.
Now, the hospital, they said that sometimes they were so overwhelmed that they were lifting, putting patients in body bags, lifting them from the bed, putting them on the floor, putting another patient in that bed straight away because there wasn't time. We went to another unit where things got so bad, they were so short of resource, that they ran out of body bags, and they were instead issued with 9-foot clear plastic sacks and cable ties. And those nurses talk about being really traumatised by that, because they had recurring nightmares about feeling like they were just throwing bodies away. These people are used to seeing death, but not on that scale and not like that.
Well, it's quite some image, isn't it? Let's talk now to George Arbuthnot, Deputy Editor of the Sunday Times Insight Team and author of Failures of State, the inside story of Britain's battle with coronavirus. George, very good afternoon from us. What will we expect to hear later on this afternoon?
So we'll hopefully see a comprehensive analysis of the decisions made during COVID. For our book, we, I guess, did a kind of mini inquiry before the inquiry, speaking to a lot of people who have since given evidence at the inquiry, politicians, epidemiologists, scientists and doctors. And the key question that they'll be trying to answer is that Britain came into the pandemic ranked as second in the world for its pandemic planning. And we ended up with Europe's worst death toll and one of the world's worst recessions, with the New York Times describing us as Plague Island. And they'll be assessing how on earth that came about.
And you followed the inquiry so closely. In your opinion, were the right questions asked of the right people to get the answers that we deserve?
I think certainly listening to the inquiry, the same evidence that we heard for our book was made clear. And what was clear from speaking to, particularly the government's top scientists, was that by far the most important reason for the disastrous outcome was Boris Johnson's three late lockdowns. On three occasions, he was advised to act swiftly and decisively by his own scientific advisors, but each time he delayed, which meant that hospitals became overwhelmed so that people didn't get the life-saving care they needed, as you just heard from that doctor. And that led to tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths and longer, more economically ruinous lockdowns, which left us in the worst of all worlds. And the government's own experts say to make that mistake once was bad enough, but to make it three times was unforgivable. And we've been paying for those mistakes ever since. The huge deficits that were run up as a result, and the reasons we have record high tax burdens, and the overwhelming of the hospitals means that we now have these record NHS backlogs, which means that people are still not getting the care they need.
This inquiry has taken so much longer, George, than inquiries in other countries. But is the merit to that amount of time? Because we will be able to find out more things that would help us were another pandemic to take hold of the world.
Yes, I do think it's important to hear from as many people as possible. I know that the families of the victims feel that was important. There is this tension between the time it takes, but also the thoroughness of it. And the inquiry is reporting as they go along. So they've had different modules. The first was on the pandemic preparedness, which is already reported, and now they're going to report on the decisions made during the pandemic period. So I don't have any criticism of that myself.
Mm. The ding-dong between Boris Johnson and Dominic Cummings is easy to get distracted by, but there is value in understanding those positions within government and hearing from advisers. Do you think that we will get something this afternoon as a kind of verdict on that relationship? Or maybe you think we shouldn't become distracted by it?
I don't think it's a distraction. I actually think it's central. Because while there was a lot of bad language and politicking going on, the actual ultimate reason for their falling out, as far as we can gather, was over the most important issue of the pandemic, which was the lockdown. In that second wave, Dominic Cummings was beseeching Boris to learn from the lesson of the first wave, which was that delaying lockdown only led to more deaths, and then you had to have a longer, more economically damaging lockdown in order to bring the pandemic back under control. And he just could not stomach the fact that we were going to make the same mistake a second time. And that's why that was the core of their falling out, and the same for Lee Kane as well. And their view was shared by the SAGE committee, but Boris and Rishi Sunak both ignored their advice in September 2020, which meant that the actual death tolls in the second and third waves were worse than the first. So the decision making deteriorated as we went along, which the SAGE committee just found absolutely astonishing. Yeah. And unbelievable.
There were also allegations of misogyny within the government. This was Boris Johnson on his team's gender balance.
One self-criticism, or another self-criticism, I think that the gender balance of my team should have been better. And to your earlier question, looking back at it, when I was running London, it was great and it was 50-50 and it was a very harmonious team. I think sometimes during the pandemic, too many meetings were too male-dominated, if I'm absolutely honest with you.
Well, obviously what we take from that is the fact that, as is often the case, more women around the table means you have a better perspective, and certainly in terms of the pandemic and kids being at home, that was hugely important, wasn't it? What do you think to Boris Johnson's apology on that front, George?
Yeah, I think that's a valid point. And I think that there was a kind of macho attitude in the Downing Street, probably in that second wave when they were ignoring the advice of the SAGE Scientific Committee, several of whom were women. And they were saying, let's stay open, let's keep the economy going. And it was just incredible short-termism. Given that it was all the advice they were getting from their own scientific committees, but also all the evidence that they'd seen from around the world from the first wave, was that those who had acted swiftly had not only had by far the lower death toll, but also had been able to open up more quickly and more fully and allowed the economy to reopen. And I suspect that a more, you know, considered less mature approach would have resulted in a much better outcome.
How confident are you that we would do it better next time?
Well, let's see what the inquiry comes out with. I have a slight concern that obviously Boris Johnson was the one who set up the inquiry and he selected the chair. And, you know, knowing Boris, you know, he's not typically one to not gain an advantage if he can. So I have a slight concern. And there are a few things I've heard from the chair during the inquiry that is slightly concern me that, you know, that they will try and be lenient on him and come back with the excuse that it was kind of unprecedented times and all that kind of thing. So let's see. But certainly there is no doubt that we will be better prepared next time. The pandemic planning before 2019 had been completely put on the back foot because of Brexit and all the equipment and supplies had been run down because of austerity. And, you know, I just hope the lessons have learned. But the problem is the longer you get away from this pandemic, the more the lessons are forgotten. So it all depends on when the next one happens, I guess.
Yep. Very good to talk to you, George. Thank you very much. That's George Arbuthnot, who is Deputy Editor of the Sunday Times Insight team. If you want to read more from George's wisdom and knowledge on this subject, he is the author of Failures of State, the inside story of Britain's battle with coronavirus. So much more on this from 4 o'clock onwards with John Pienaar. And do you remember that phrase, unprecedented times, Jane, which was frequently in the ether? It's a bit like global headwinds, which is in the ether at the moment.
Yes.
And we fully understand, don't we, as people, that there are very difficult things that countries face and that the world faces. But you just hope that there is a preparedness for unprecedented times within a government.
You'd hope. It will be really interesting to see what is said in that report about the conduct of the Prime Minister at the time. I don't think it's unreasonable to suggest that we've probably had Prime Ministers before and since who might have been slightly better in that situation. I don't think that's an unreasonable thing to say. Perhaps he wasn't quite the man for that time. trying to be as even-handed as possible. Right.
I don't think you need to be. I mean, the man
was the worst possible person to be Prime Minister at the time.
Apologise to the inquiry for things that at the time people were saying, you mustn't do this, you mustn't do this. They were wise people with experience telling him, and he just went ahead and did it. And I think that, you know, many of the points that George Arbuthnot made there, it's quite painful for us to relive that time, isn't it? But that point about having more women around the table, I mean, it's not, you know, some kind of wokeism. It was about putting families, because it costs so much to close those schools in terms of, you know, what then happened at home. And at times, there was barely a female voice, a childcare voice around the table making those decisions. So plenty more to talk about from 4 o'clock this afternoon. We'd love your thoughts.
Yeah, and John will certainly be right across that from 4 here on Times Radio. We're going to talk modern art, abstract art, specifically Jackson Pollock.
Oh, Jace.
Jason's his cousin. It wasn't as successful, oddly enough. And we're talking about why children are actually just better able to mimic the works of Jackson Pollock, who was, of course, married to
Lee Krasner.
Oh, well done. This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wiggs. The experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
Oh, we can all be a bit forgetful from time to time, and Mom was no exception. Always losing her glasses and then not being able to find them again. It's a good job they were 2 for 1 at the opticians.
At the last count, I think she had 12 pairs.
Yeah, but there came a point when we noticed that it was more than just being a bit forgetful. And that's when we knew that Mum was going to need someone to give her some extra help around the house.
So that's where we got Claire in to help. She's Mum's care professional from Home Instead. She's wonderful and comes to the house most days. Home Instead are amazing. It really is the best quality care in your own home. And it's really reassuring to know that Mum's being looked after by someone as patient and kind as Claire.
Yeah, and as well as all the day-to-day stuff that Claire does, she also helps Mum with her favourite thing in the world, baking. Mum's chocolate cake was always the talk of the town, and it turns out that with Claire's help, it still is.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Co-op members now get prices matched to Aldi. Hold on, no way. Okay then, so co-op members now get everyday essentials price matched to Aldi. Sign up and start saving. Co-op, owned by you, right by you. I wasn't expecting that.
Co-op member prices matched versus comparable selected products at Aldi GB. Co-op membership required. Co-op group food stores only. See co-op.co.uk/Aldi price match.
Download the free Times Radio app from the App Store or Google Play today.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wix have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wix.co.uk.
Is it possible then that modern art is actually child's play? Anyone over the age of, what, a year and a half could probably have a bash. A new study, which asked children and adults to make Jackson Pollock-style paintings, found that indeed children were better at it. The study cited Pollock's traumatic birth. Now, I didn't know this. He was almost strangled by his own umbilical cord during his birth, and that led to reduced dexterity in later life. And many believe, of course, that that contributed to his very distinctive style. I've been talking to Alexandra Steinacker-Clark, art historian, writer, and host of the All About Art podcast. Here she is explaining why children might be better able to mimic Pollock's work.
Well, I think it's quite interesting because in the article, it does state that it is down to the physicality. It's the way that children move. But I also think that, yes, it can be the way that children move, and it can be contributed to the fact that Jackson Pollock suffered some health issues. He also did suffer from alcoholism later in his life. And so these things could have made his motor skills a little bit more akin to what we might see in children versus then in adults. However, I also think that a huge contribution to that is the fact that children have a way of letting things go, a way of being a little bit more free with how they think and how they move and how they feel. I think that adults carry a lot of experiences and a lot of different sort of ways of conditioning that we have built throughout our lives with us. And I don't know if you've ever tried to paint an abstract painting, but I've tried to paint abstract painting.
How did it go?
And it's incredibly difficult because it's so hard to actually let go of all of these things that you hold in your mind. I was trying to paint an abstract painting and all of a sudden I was painting a flower. Mm-hmm. It's so difficult to let things go and be quite free. And I think this idea of, oh, well, my child could have done that is said in a derogatory way. But actually, I think it's quite interesting because why is that derogatory? It's so difficult for adults to reach a similar sort of childlike wonder and freedom of what children can experience in their minds, having not necessarily had the experience that adults have.
It's really,
so I think that's almost a compliment. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no. It's just really interesting to hear you say that actually to paint something in a naive style, which we might moronically think was really easy, is far from easy, as you've just explained. It's just you've either got an ability or you haven't. And most of us, in fact, I'm someone with, I couldn't draw a flower, and it wouldn't be naive, it wouldn't be realistic, I just couldn't do it. Can I also ask, is it possible to tell from any kind of work of art the age of the artist?
I think nowadays, probably not. I think that we could all be very surprised at the ages of different artists, unless maybe it would be something hyper-realist with extreme technicality and skill with a paintbrush. I think that sort of type of approach might need someone who has fully developed motor skills. But other than that, I think that it's quite interesting that nowadays, no, I think that you could probably, I mean, thinking about what are some of the well-known artists, Andre Butzer is a well-known artist who paints in sort of a cartoon-like style, or even Carol Apple, who was a modern painter. He is also someone who paints in that more like cartoon-like style. And those are all styles that I think even you could find on your fridge that your child has painted. But that's not said in a derogatory way, but instead they have developed these skills to be able to free themselves from thinking about painting within a sort of idea of perfectionism as well.
And I wonder whether the Jackson Pollock style, I suppose he is uniquely irritating, let's just be honest, to people who know nothing about art, and I would call myself one of these people, basically a Philistine. I do look at it and I just think, I'm sorry, that isn't very good. It's wiggles, it's squiggles, it's splodges. And would I want to have it in my home as something to delight in? I'm afraid, Alexandra, the answer is an emphatic no. I'd like a nice watercolour of a sunset.
I can understand that. And that's also why art is so wonderful, because it is subjective. However, may I ask, have you ever seen one of these paintings in person?
No. No, I haven't.
And this makes a huge difference.
Okay.
I had the privilege of going to the Museum of Modern Art in New York and seeing one of these paintings. They are larger than life. It takes up the whole wall. And when you walk up to it, you can almost imagine yourself placed in front of the canvas with Jackson Pollock, dancing around and spraying the paint and dripping it all over. It's really quite marvelous to see these in person. It's breathtaking. And what I also think is, you know, these paintings, in terms of having it up on your wall at home and living with it, that is one factor of thinking about how you can appreciate and enjoy art. But on the other hand, there's so much within these drip paintings, so much history and so much that reflects the changing of the times. It reflects society at the time. It reflects other parts of art history, a departure from maybe paintings that depicted things on a more figurative level. But also, and this is within the article that we're discussing today, it's also interesting to see how natural body movements can mimic the forms that we find in nature, which is also why psychologically some people find these paintings calming, meditative, or otherwise very stimulating and interesting to look at. So there are so many different facets to enjoying a work of art.
There you go. The Case for Modern Art from Alexandra Steinacker-Clark, a writer and host of the All About Art podcast. Just out of interest, if you are in the Pollock is just awful camp, it's just worth noting that his most expensive painting, Number 5, 1948, was sold back in 2006 for $140 million. So what do you know if you don't like it? What's coming next?
A city 500 metres high and 170 kilometres long, built in the desert. What could go wrong? Let's get the latest headlines with Tom Noonan.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary has laid out her plans to double the length of time a legal migrant has to wait to apply for permanent residency in the UK. Rather than 5 years at the moment, the baseline wait time will now be 10 years. Shabana Mahmood has laid out some cases in which people will not have to wait that long, though.
Those who speak English to a degree level standard could qualify for a 9-year path to settlement. Those paying the higher rate of tax could qualify at 5 years, while those on the top rate could qualify after 3, the same as those on global talent visas. Those who work in a public service, including doctors, teachers, nurses, would qualify after 5 years.
Other factors, like claiming benefits or initially arriving in the UK through an illegal route, would add to the wait time. A former police officer, who is one of the country's most notorious sex offenders, has been given his 37th life sentence. David Carrick was found guilty yesterday of 2 more cases, one for molesting a 12-year-old girl when he was 14, and then one for raping and abusing his girlfriend when he was a police officer and she was a university student. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky will meet top US Army officials in Kyiv this afternoon after the US and Russia drew up their own peace plan. That proposal would require Ukraine to cede land to Moscow and to halve the size of its army. And the chairman of BBC Children in Need has resigned weeks into the role after seriously injuring a cyclist while driving. Terry Duddy tried to turn right off a road in Buckinghamshire when he hit the woman in his 50s with his 4x4 BMW, knocking her off her bike when she had right of way. Don't forget, you can set the Times News Briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives, Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
I'm Adam Vaughan, environment editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Get the day's politics, business and sport every weekday in breakfast from 6:30 a.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the spend and save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar's got some superb guests this afternoon. General David Petraeus will be on his programme, former CIA director and US commander of Central Command in Afghanistan and Iraq. Leila Moran, chair of the Health and Social Care Select Committee, will be on as well. Nadra Ahmed, executive chairman of the National Care Association, and the chair of the COVID inquiry report, Baroness Hallett, will be speaking live after four on the second findings of the COVID inquiry. Now, get yourself a nice cup of tea, have a sit down and a biscuit, and imagine the future of living. A 170-mile-long city, only 200 metres wide, that rises 500 metres high. Built with a mirrored facade in a straight line across the Saudi Arabian desert, capable of housing up to 9 million people. Is there something in your hobnob? The line was meant to be the futuristic jewel in the crown for the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Blade Runner baby of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. It was meant to contain a marina with a gate as high as London's Shard, a 45,000-seat stadium at the top of a building 350 metres high, and a suspended office block called the Chandelier. But it's possible that the whole thing might go belly up. Work on the project seems to be grinding to a halt. In a moment, we'll talk to the head of Cambridge University's Sustainable Design Group. But first, we're joined by Tom Pashby, senior reporter at New Civil Engineer, who's been covering the twists and turns of the NEOM project. Hello, Tom.
Hi, thank you for having me on.
Well, it's absolutely our pleasure. I mean, the more that I've read about this extraordinary project, the more I've felt it's just one big joke on mankind. But it was serious in its immense ambition, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, the project developers in Saudi Arabia would also say would say that they are still serious about developing the project, as would engineering companies if they spoke. But the engineering companies are all seem to be bound by non-disclosure agreements.
Okay, so what do we know about what the line was meant to be?
The line is meant to be the flagship project of the overall NEOM gigaproject. So the NEOM gigaproject is actually at least five different mega projects. So when we think of mega projects in the UK, that would be like HS2 or Tideway or Sizewell C. But this is a giga project, so it's like a series of mega projects. And those mega projects are Magna, Sindala, Trojena, The Line and Oxagon. And The Line was supposed to be kind of the centre point of all of this, bisecting the entire region in the middle. And it's supposed to obviously be home to however many millions of people. But the problems that have come up with The Line suggest that they want to now build it in phases, which raises questions about whether there would be a sustainable population for an urban environment, because you need to have a certain amount of people to be able to have these environments flourish and exist.
Yep. And talk us through, Tom, what The Line is actually meant to look like, both inside and out.
I mean, I would love to know the truth about this, but there's a very kind of small amount of information that comes out of The Line officially. The stuff that we do here tends to be project leaders speaking at conferences, which happened in the past couple of months, and they explain that they would like for it to be kind of a rolled up city where they have avenues running in the sky. So you have different communities running at different parts of the line in the air. This kind of, I mean, it might not even make sense because it does sound so sci-fi, but it's like, it's The Line kind of, you explained at the beginning that it's supposed to go 500 metres in the air, but that's kind of a rolled up city.
Okay. I mean, it's just so bizarre. I've looked at computer generated imaging of The Line, yeah, and just not understood what I'm looking at. So what I've seen, Tom, is, you know, just this huge long line, 170 yeah, miles long, a mirrored facade, and then yeah, I'm meant to imagine that inside there are several different levels that will have yeah, roads, flats, hospitals, schools, yeah, but you will only ever be able to travel in a linear way, won't you? I mean, 200 metres is not very wide for a city, is it?
These are all very good questions, and I'm sure ones that, you know, it would be interesting to put to Neon properly. They kind of change their tone every now and then about how they want people to live, like within sort of 15-minute neighbourhoods within the line, but also having high-speed rail at the very bottom of the line that means that you could go into the mountains, to the airport. That is no longer being built. And it being a massive kind of simple monolithic structure means that you might have issues with things like thermal expansion and seismic movement. Because, I mean, in the Financial Times article that was about The Line, it showed that it would be the distance from London to Norfolk. Like that's how long the line itself is. If you imagine any major structure is going to have issues with thermal expansion and weathering, but none of those things seem to necessarily be being directly addressed by the managers. Mm.
And can you just describe the landscape that the line would be in?
Yeah. So if you can see it on Google Earth, you can see some of the kind of the early earthworks and foundations that are going in and some vehicle movements. It is generally desert in the western proportion, meeting the Gulf of Aqaba, I think that's how you say it, which has access to the Suez Canal, and then you can have access to Asia in theory in the south. But it then goes into the mountains in the west. They say that it's supposed to be level, as in the same height compared to sea level all the way through to the mountains, but I'm sure you can imagine mountains go up. So it's unclear whether they're just going to burrow straight into the mountains or if they've already done that, because they have done some tunnelling. But yeah, it's desert. And I'm not an expert in geotechnics, so I'm not sure what the actual material is, but it looks like a lot of sand and I guess rocks.
It does look like a lot of sand. Tom, thank you very much indeed for that. Let's talk now to Renita Bardham, who is Professor of Sustainable Built Environment at Cambridge University. In its original ambitions, Professor, were you very impressed with what the line was setting out to do?
I think what I when I looked at NEOM, I think it is a fantastic, fascinating experiment, although perhaps not the most frugal one, and that's something came across immediately. But to my understanding, if global sustainability needed a monument or a flagship project to access, probably that is certainly this is a candidate. My only concern is it's a visionary in scale, definitely, with all the AI system, integrated systems for 9 million population. fantastic, but this visionary in scale project, although there are challenges to the physics of heat, water, materials, carbon, remains stubbornly real. So I would definitely, NEOM appeared to me as a good experiment to study. But then another thing that also it came to me, are we moving to a future where we are going to build cities in a box and then you're going to transport those cities anywhere we want, irrespective of climate, irrespective of culture, irrespective of diversity that a city is required to thrive. So there is absolutely very little opportunities of repair there.
Sure. And so I think you make such good points about its insular nature, because if you look at the plans, you do see this extraordinary desert landscape. And we're just talking about the Line project, part of the NEOM project at the moment. And you see rising from that desert this mirrored kind of, you know, extraordinarily long office block, basically. And it is hard to see how that is in any way friendly to its environment. And in fact, so many people have already pointed out that birds would fly straight into it, mammals wouldn't be able to migrate in the way that they wanted to, and also there's no water. So the whole thing just seems so hard to imagine becoming a reality.
I completely agree with you, because the geography fights the climate rather than the work with it. And so creating a city that is insular in nature, but also in a place which will require massive amount of cooling energy in order to for the people to survive there. Even if they promise operational carbon would be minimal with all sorts of renewables integrated to it, I think there is huge amount of embodied carbon that is being trapped here, not just in the construction phase, but also in the materials in itself. And it's almost like to me, I order a three-course dessert and then promise myself that I'm going to eat salad for the rest of the day. I don't think that sort of sustainability question makes we shouldn't be moving towards that sort of a sustainability. Yeah. Ecological footprints are challenged.
And has there been much talk about it within your own circles? What have other people made of this plan?
I think occasionally students, researchers come up with ideas of what does NEOM really mean and how does it redefine, or does it even redefine sustainability? But over and over again in all sustainability discourse, and we know we are amidst COP and where we are, this is probably quite central to our discussions. Sustainability is not about creating something that has a huge amount of carbon footprint and then we promise that we are going to remove that over multiple years. I think it's also about social inclusivity. It's also about culture. It's also about context. It's also about trying to not disrupt the ecological systems. The city will require huge amount of desalination for its cooling loads, for the population to thrive. But it also would create an imbalance in the whole ecological system. The whole marine system would probably be disbalanced. And these are questions really important in interdisciplinary context of sustainability, and probably I see very little discussions around that.
It has been quite a statement from Saudi Arabia, hasn't it, that this is what they want to do, this is the way that they imagine their direction of travel. But quite a lot of people have got on board that direction of travel. There are a lot of consultancies and agencies and architects who've been very happy to take the money from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia to be part of that. I wonder whether you've got any thoughts about that.
Absolutely. The mega projects like this often serve as national branding tools. They attract investments, signal that they're modern, and the demonstration of technological capacity and advancement is another level. I'm pretty sure there's less oversight into what it means to our future cities. I think the architects or engineers who have been commissioned to do it and have taken up a lot of responsibilities to build this project probably require a discourse on what does it mean to our future of sustainability, the challenge is ensuring that these symbols of progress that is being promised through these technical firms who are promising this to deliver this, they match sustainability principles rather than sidestep them. So it shouldn't be a checkbox exercise.
Thank you very much indeed for talking to us. That's Renita Bardam, who is Professor of the Sustainable Built Environment at Cambridge University. We also heard from Tom Pashby, Senior Reporter at New Civil Engineer. Akaba is the correct pronunciation. Our thanks to James Williams for that. It's an extraordinary development. Some of it might still come to fruition, Jane. It's not for me, I have to say, but it might be for other people.
I'm going to call it an act of folly.
Are you? Okay. Yeah. I think there's something just very strange about choosing to go and live in a desert without water in a building and having a whole life where all of those things have to be shipped into you. So all of your water and then the sewage has to be shipped out. I don't know. I think it's asking a lot of the planet.
I think it really is. And actually, talking of the planet...
Yes, Jane?
I'm going to offer some reassurance. This is from NASA. The space agency has said, all evidence points to an object that has entered our solar system being an interstellar comet. Now, this is significant because there's been a lot of frothing that this might be some sort of spaceship from another world. NASA are very keen to say it isn't. It's been called 3i Atlas. It's only the third interstellar object of its kind ever to have entered our solar system. So there is some significance here. Here's the Associate Administrator of NASA. It's Dr. Nikki Fox. She's been a guest on this programme. She is from, did we say Berkhamsted?
We did say Berkhamsted.
Yes, that's Dr. Nikki Fox. She's one of us. She's a Brit. Here she is reassuring the nation, indeed the world, that we shouldn't be worried about this object.
Our telescopes are always watching the skies to keep us safe, and in doing so, they occasionally make major scientifically interesting discoveries, just like this one. Right away, of course, NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office established, they studied it, and they established that 3i Atlas is not a danger to Earth. In fact, it's at least twice as far away as the distance between the Earth and our Sun.
Okay, it's not a danger to us. It's not a spaceship. I hope you'll sleep a little bit better tonight if you were a little concerned about that. It's 10 to 3. You're with Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG, the champions of zero commission investing. Every Monday to Thursday afternoon, John Pienaar brings you a perfectly balanced portfolio of up-to-the-minute news, unrivaled analysis and expert opinion. John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive. Every Monday to Thursday afternoon from 4 on Times Radio with IG. Trade, invest, progress. Search IG.com to find out more. Capital at risk, other fees may apply.
The Story, the award-winning daily news podcast from The Times. Listen in the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia and we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
I believe those who are curious see the world differently. At Viking, we have always been curious and quite a bit different. For over 25 years, we've been connecting the thinking person with the world. First on the great rivers, then on all five oceans, now on all seven continents. We are One Viking, exploring the world in comfort.
Chase is the digital bank you can count on.
How so?
Because you get 1% cash back on your grocery shop.
Like on prosciutto?
Yeah, prosciutto.
And seaweed crackers?
Sure, those two.
Oh, hang on, what about rotisserie chickens?
If it's in your grocery shop, Chase has got your cash back. Join today and get 1% cash back on debit card spending on groceries, fuel and everyday transport. Chase, see what your money can do. 18 plus UK residents eligibility applies. 1% cash back for your first year. Maximum £15 per month. Exceptions apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Take a quick trip to correction corner.
Yes, no, really important. Not Berkhamsted, Hitchin.
It makes all the difference. Yeah. Is it?
One of them is in Buckinghamshire, one of them is in Hertfordshire. Yeah.
Okay, that was Dr. Nikki Fox, anyway, from NASA, basically telling us we've got nothing to worry about.
And that was the important thing that anyone should have taken from that brief interlude into space.
100%.
Whichever home county's county you're in.
Jane Mulcairns is here with news of the Times magazine this weekend, and there's a big article about why it's unfashionable to have a boyfriend. Can you explain this, please?
Yep. So last month, Vogue ran a piece called Having a Boyfriend is Embarrassing. And it went viral with lots of hot takes in response. Basically, it was saying that having a boyfriend hasn't got any kind of social capital anymore, and people aren't posting about them on Instagram anymore. And if they have got them, they're definitely not posting about them. You know, they're a bit more subtle about it, and also just people are denying it entirely. We have given our own more thoughtful take, I would say. It's not just a hot take, it's, you know...
Well,
a warm and well-thought-out take.
Yes, explain just how thoughtful it is.
And also Olivia Petter and Katie Glass. Basically, there is something a bit sort of deeper than that. So there's a sort of take that sort of says, you know, men aren't up to it and women are just fed up of it, and that app dating has ruined romance and nobody knows how to chat anyone up. And all of those things, I think, are true to a certain extent. I mean, we had Scott Galloway in the magazine a few weeks ago talking about how... He says 45% of men aged 18 to 25 have never approached a woman in real life as opposed to online to ask them on a date, which is just gobsmacking. And, you know, there is an awful lot of bad behaviour on the apps. But anyway, I think it runs a bit deeper than just women are fed up. The Economist has said that there's a great relationship recession going on, and that the number of Americans aged 23 to 34 living without a partner has doubled in five decades to 50% for men and 41% for women. And they say, you know, this is obviously, it's because, it's, you know, women can own houses and everything now. Women can have babies on their own. You know, we're more financially independent than ever. There's no social stigma to living on your own. You're not going to be cast out of society. And that basically women's standards have become more exacting. So, you know, if the options are just sort of mediocre, you don't have to settle for those things because you don't financially need a partner to get by anymore. And I actually think that the sort of boyfriend is cringe thing is a bit reductive, but I think and I hope that it's just a shorthand for a rejection of just this enormous heteronormativity that says that coupledom is the only way. You know, if you think about all the ads we're bombarded with and all the images we're bombarded with, it's all, you know, romance, coupledom, marriage, motherhood, fatherhood, you know, John Lewis adverts, for example. I mean, it's all about that. And I just think that other scripts aren't really validated in the same way by society.
Yeah.
And I hope that this rejection of boyfriend is cringe thing is about that. It's about saying that other scripts are valid too.
Okay, but would there be an article featuring three attractive, accomplished, single men saying, we don't, you know, girlfriends are unfashionable?
I mean, yes, if there were three men willing to write that,
is that wanted to give thoughtful takes, that men wouldn't write it? Or wouldn't be asked to write it.
But the demographics aren't saying that. They're saying that men do want girlfriends and they're unable to find them because they don't know how to ask for them.
And some the women are happier are saying on their women, own.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, but not all women. As in fact, Sophie, one of the contributors to the article, does say she would like a boyfriend.
Yeah, no, Olivia Petter says, you know, she says, you know, she would quite like a boyfriend and the internet says it's embarrassing. You know, and I mean, I don't think that's necessarily true. That's her particular take on it. But I think what is possibly true is that there's been a shift in the fact that you wouldn't brag about it on the internet, maybe in the same way that perhaps a few years ago you used to. There's this sort of interesting take that's saying, you know, having a boyfriend is Republican, which I quite enjoy, that it's sort of somehow seen as a bit sort of socially conservative to be like, oh, you know, 15 years with this one. And well, that's kind of thing.
That's a funny quote from Katie Glass, who says, couples who post each other are pathetic, that's her view, particularly cringe are those gushy posts about 15 years with this one,
yeah.
Especially when you know that behind the scenes she cheated on him with her mate from the running club. Right, let's move on to Joseph Fiennes, who's a great actor, and actually he's in a series I am definitely going to be watching. He is in Prisoner 951. It's about Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. He plays Richard Ratcliffe. He also played Gareth Southgate, and you've interviewed him, and he sounds very nice.
I have, yeah. I have to say, if Joe Fiennes was my boyfriend,
well,
I wasn't going to make
that appalling link.
There'd be an Instagram post coming.
I'd be posting non-stop about lovely Joseph Fiennes, but he's happily married. 15 years with that one, so, you know, absolutely fine. But yeah, I've interviewed him a few times and he really is a thoroughly good egg. He's just so thoughtful and a brilliant actor, as you say. It's really interesting. He first got very famous from Shakespeare in Love when he was about 28. And actually, weirdly, he's now 55 and probably more famous because of playing Gareth Southgate on stage.
He does look
in
like
James
him.
Graham's Yeah. I mean, they've both got very big brown eyes. Mm. They've both sort of slightly receding hair, bit of a beard. But he did have prosthetic teeth to play Gareth Southgate. But that was the only prosthetics that he used. And the waistcoat, obviously, which changes everything. But yeah, he's in this amazing new BBC drama, which starts on Sunday. And he plays Richard Ratcliffe. It is quite a punchy drama. It's I think four parts, and it covers the time from Nazanin being taken and held hostage to her release. And the government, I will say, comes off not that well.
Who plays Boris Johnson? Because he played a part, didn't he, in her continued detention?
I can't remember who plays Boris Johnson. Anyway, somebody plays Boris Johnson. Mm. And it's taken from the actual transcripts of those interactions with the Foreign Office and the government and Tulip Siddiqui and everything, who was their MP. So it is word for word of his dealings with the government. And it is the government comes across as... The British government comes across as deeply unhelpful to a person whose wife is being held in an Iranian prison. It's punchy. It's really well worth watching. And he's also going to be, I should say, Gareth Southgate in the TV adaptation of Dear England, which is coming to your screens next year.
And very briefly, Cheryl Hines is in the mag, the star of Curb Your Enthusiasm, who found herself married to RFK Jr. And the interview reveals that that's quite the trip.
I mean, yeah, on the other hand, imagine your boyfriend's RFK Jr.
Yeah, let's not.
So Katie Balls, the hardest working woman in Washington, has interviewed him. Just at the beginning of their relationship, Cheryl Hines said to him, I mean, it's a fair question when you're going out with a Kennedy. She said, has he got any interest in politics? And he said, absolutely not. She said, great, it's going to work out perfectly. That man is the health minister in America.
Thank you very much. Jane Mulcairns, The Times Mag on Saturday.
Across the UK, on DAB digital radio, online and on your smart speaker. This is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
All of that takes us to 3 o'clock. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio. In the next hour of our programme, Zelensky is meeting US military leaders in the Pentagon today. We'll ask how close a peace plan is for Ukraine. We'll talk to a former social worker and child trauma specialist who got in touch with the show following our report about children in care. And Bromley's best export, Tom Allen, joins us after 3:30. Let's get the very latest news with Tom Noonan.
Thank you, Fee. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says some legal migrants will now have to wait up to 20 years to get settled status. Shabana Mahmood wants to double the standard baseline wait from 5 to 10 years, but she says low-paid foreign workers who arrived on health and social care visas in recent years will now face a baseline of 15 years, with some years added for benefit claimants. The Home Secretary says any changes would apply immediately to those waiting, but there will be no changes to people who already have permanent residency.
Fairness is the most fundamental of British values. We made a promise when we gave them settlement, and we do not break our promises. The Reform Party, I note, not present today, have said they will do this most un-British of things. The Tories have said that they will, but then said that they won't, and I am left in as much of a muddle about their policy as they are.
The Conservatives say the proposals are their own ideas. The former police officer David Carrick has been handed his 37th life sentence for sexual crimes. He was yesterday found guilty of assaulting two more women, a 12-year-old girl when he was a teenager in the 1980s, and the other is his partner, who he raped and abused 20 years later when he was an officer. Police and crime commentator Danny Shaw says that first crime should have been an opportunity to stop him joining the police.
After he was sort of found out when he was 14, the victim was 12, a written note was filed with his medical records in which he'd admitted abusing the girl and had said that it's true, but he'd stopped. And if that note had been discovered or the authorities had been alerted when he applied for the police, things could have been very different. But sadly, that didn't happen.
Carrick admitted 71 sexual crimes, including 48 rapes over a 17-year period. Ukraine's president will meet top US Army officials after Washington drew up a peace plan with Russia. The 28-point plan, agreed between the White House and the Kremlin, would see Ukraine cede all of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions, including land that it currently holds, as well as halving the size of its army. The COVID inquiry will release its second report this afternoon, focusing on decision-making in Boris Johnson's government. Former ministers were questioned over how they decided on policies like lockdown, social distancing and the Eat Out to Help Out scheme. The former Lloyds boss has lost a job offer at a major insurer after his previous employer launched an investigation into an alleged workplace affair. John Neal was due to be the president of AIG's American operations, which would have earned him £13 million next year. And Wales and Northern Ireland have found out that they won't both be able to qualify for next summer's Men's World Cup. They've been drawn in the same playoff pathway, where four teams will compete for one place. In the first round of those knockouts, Northern Ireland have to go away to Italy and Wales need to beat Bosnia and Herzegovina. It means if Northern Ireland lose, Wales may have to face Italy themselves. But former forward Robert Earnshaw isn't worried.
Italy just lost 4-1 to Norway. Right now, this team is very good, but not historically very good in terms of big names going out and beating most people. They're not doing that right now.
For news when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens and Bathrooms.
So the ever-entertaining Tom Allen joins us after 3.30 this afternoon. He has got into gardening and he's going to sell it to me. I think Fee's already, you're moderately interested, aren't you?
Vaguely interested. I'm kind of gardening adjacent in my interest.
Yes, yeah. You are. Okay. Yeah. Right, lovely. So we'll have a full-bodied discussion of the joys of gardening.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, we've really sold it there.
Do you think we have? I don't know.
I'm mildly interested. You're not there yet. Come in, Tom.
Take us there, Tom. He'll be with us after 3.30. You are with Times Radio. And top US military officials are meeting Ukrainian leaders, including President Zelensky, today. This comes after the US and Russia drew up a peace plan together. The deal would require Ukraine to hand land to Moscow and more than halve its army. Now, in a moment, I'll talk to Kurt Volker, former US ambassador to NATO. In Donald Trump's first term, he was the US special representative for negotiations in Ukraine. First, though, we'll have a word with Edward Lucas, author of Deception, Spies, Lies and How Russia Dupes the West. Edward Lucas, it's hard to see how a deal cooked up by the US and Russia in any way suits Ukraine. What do you think?
Well, it certainly doesn't suit Ukraine. And I think that as things stand, this deal has about as much chance of success as Northern Ireland winning the Men's World Cup, or possibly slightly less. There's just no way the Ukrainians will agree to any of these terms. But of course, they may be made to. And that's, I think, the real question is how much pressure Trump is willing to put on the Ukrainians, and also how much pressure he's willing to put on us. And my real nightmare in this is that Trump comes to the Europeans and the Brits and says, make the Ukrainians sign up to this deal, otherwise I will punish you. And that will put us in a very difficult position.
That is an alarming prospect. Do you think it's likely?
I think that what we've seen so far is that Trump's attention span is fairly short and he is happy to lash out more often at the Ukrainians, although sometimes at the Russians, but then he moves on. So to conduct a really successful sort of geopolitical shift like this would require very sustained attention and officials of a sort of Henry Kissinger type effectiveness, and I don't see that in the administration. So I suspect that Professor Lawrence Friedman is right in his assessment that this is just another dead end. It's like the Alaska summit and the proposed Budapest summit. It'll be not even a 9-day wonder, a 9-hour wonder. But we never know with Trump, and I think that although he's got very little ability to follow through on positive international initiatives, he does have the ability to sabotage things and put pressure on people, as we've seen with the tariff war, for example. So if he said to the Europeans, make this happen, otherwise I'm pulling the Americans out of NATO, what would we do?
What could we do?
Well, rather like the man being asked for directions, who says, "I wouldn't start from here." We have put ourselves in a position where, although we in Europe are plenty big enough and rich enough to defend ourselves and our friends, we'd be very hard put to it without the American intelligence and high-tech support, without the American sort of muscle in terms of logistics and moving things around, and without the American combat power. We've hollowed out our armed forces to the extent that now the Ukrainian armed forces are the strongest, most capable in Europe. And they are, of course, as we should remember, they are defending us as well as their own country. And so if our defence is a mess, that puts a big weight on our deterrence. What could we do to Russia to scare off Russia? And that's pretty weak too at the moment, and it's something that I'm working on very hard, is trying to find out what we can put on our escalation ladder. So if Russia cuts cables or threatens to disrupt our air traffic, buzzes our airspace, or blows things up or burns things down or beats people up or does other mischief, what do we have in response? And that is, I'm afraid, still very much a work in progress.
Gosh, this is an incredibly gloomy picture you're painting. And of course, there's been activity this week, hasn't there, in Poland on a railway line and off the coast of the UK as well.
Well, I do weddings and bar mitzvahs as well, if you need clearing up.
No, I won't be booking you, Edward, I have to tell you.
But I'm serious, you know, this has been going on for years, and in fact, I would say it predates Putin, and we were warned about this again and again from Estonians and Latvians and Lithuanians and Poles and others. And for years, we poo-pooed these warnings and patronised and belittled the people who are trying to tell us that there's a real threat from an imperial Russia that can't live at peace with its neighbours and isn't happy with the post-1991 security order in Europe, wants a cordon sanitaire around it, and repression at home and aggression abroad. And we've left it very late. Now, I still think there's plenty we can do, and I hope that we will do it. I was glad to see the House of Commons Defence Committee coming out with a blistering report on the lack of defence preparedness. But I'm afraid it will not just be expensive, it'll be inconvenient and quite risky. And I don't think that we're getting the political leadership to warn the population about this, and I don't think the population is ready.
Thank you very much, Edward Lucas, author of Deception, Spies, Lies and How Russia Dupes the West. We can talk now to Ambassador Kurt Volker, former US Special Representative for Negotiations in Ukraine. Ambassador Volker, welcome to the programme. There's no chance, as our previous guest was saying, that the Ukrainians will go for this, is there?
No, of course not. This is a half-baked idea. It's notable that President Trump hasn't said anything about it. This is people traveling to Ukraine. It appears to be Vance and Witkoff who are pushing this. It's a set of points that were worked out with the Russians without the Ukrainians. It kind of strikes me as if we had sat down with Hamas and prepared a plan to present to Israel. It's just simply not going to go anywhere.
Right. I mean, when you actually look at it, it is quite incredible. They would have to give up areas of Donbass, cut their armed forces, forego weapons, particularly long-range missiles, adopt Russian as an official language. I mean, it is crazy stuff. So why bother at all?
Yeah. The only thing among those things that you mentioned that's not crazy is actually giving the Russian language an official status, because a lot of Ukrainians do speak Russian.
It. Okay, yeah. So language. You would tick that box. Yeah.
But the rest of it is crazy.
Right.
There's no way they can do that. And it's inherently contradictory, because on the one hand, they say they're providing a security guarantee to Ukraine in the future if they agree to these onerous terms. And yet they're stripping Ukraine of any military capability, which is what a security guarantee would have to be based on, is training, equipping, and making sure that Ukraine can defend itself. And if it's simply a matter of relying on U.S. assurances that we'll respond if Russia attacks again, well, what credibility is there in that? When we didn't do it with the Budapest Memorandum, we just stood by. And then we are actually telling Ukraine to give up territory that Russia doesn't even control in exchange for security. Well, how does that make any sense? So this is a plan that is destined to be stillborn. And I think we are going to be back in the same situation we've been in for this whole time here. Putin does not want peace. He wants to make this war. And in order to convince him not to do that, you have to put on enough pressure that he has an incentive to stop it. This plan is just a distraction from that.
Okay. So once again, Trump and Witkoff have been well and truly played by a master manipulator.
I would not put Trump in the same category this time because he has been remarkably silent. So he's allowing his team to go and say, you want to go give this a try? Give it a try. But he has clearly given himself the ability to walk away from this, too.
Okay. What do you make of Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State? There are suggestions that he isn't altogether keen on it. What do you think about that?
Well, he would be crazy if he was keen on it because it is such a bad plan. Rubio, I think, sees himself as the expert and the grown-up in the room who can make sure the worst things don't happen. And so he's sticking around and, you know, protecting some sense of normal national security policy for fear of worse things happening. But at the same time, by playing that role, I think he has marginalized his own influence within the Trump administration.
Right. So he's no longer a particularly significant figure?
Well, I'm not sure that he ever was particularly significant. This is an administration of one person. That's Donald Trump. He is the one making the decisions, who is deciding where, what to do, what not to do. And I don't think Witkoff or Rubio or Keith Kellogg or Pete Hegseth or even J.D. Vance really has much input into Trump's decisions.
Right. Keith Kellogg was viewed, I think, by many people as relatively pro Zelensky in Ukraine. He's the U.S. special envoy, but he's leaving, isn't he?
Yeah, he announced this week that he's going to be stepping down at the end of his mandate as a special representative. It's notable that he did that publicly this week at a time when this half-baked peace plan comes out. So clearly that seems to be an indication of some displeasure with that as well. I'm convinced that if Trump had wanted to keep Keith Kellogg on and use him as he could find a way around the special envoy 300 and some day deadline. But Kellogg, it seems, has decided not to even push for that.
And what would you say, if anything, about the so-called coalition of the willing?
Essential. It is an essential step. What I think will happen eventually with Ukraine, and unfortunately this peace plan may have set us back a few months, but what will eventually happen is Putin will agree to stop the war in place. He'll just have a ceasefire because he will see a need to do that, as well as Ukraine seeing a need to do that. When that happens, we have to lay on support for Ukraine financially, militarily, politically, and notably create a stronger Ukraine so we can deter the next Russian attack. And a coalition of the willing deployment in Ukraine to help train and equip, monitor, assist with air defense, integrate systems. These are all things that will help make Ukraine stronger and contribute to that future deterrence, which is what we'll need.
So it's fanciful to imagine a future in which British troops aren't on the ground in Ukraine?
Well, you know, it is dependent, I think. Every other country has said it's dependent upon there being a ceasefire. I know there have been calls for a deployment of a coalition of the willing force, even in advance of a ceasefire. I would be in favor of that. But so far, it doesn't seem the British government is willing to go that far. So there is a scenario where Putin just never has a ceasefire, always keeps up the fighting, and this coalition never deploys. I think that would be a mistake, because I think if we really want to get back to a situation of stability and peace in Europe, even if it's a tense peace, we're going to have to stop Putin from attacking again. And I do think British troops, a coalition of the willing, will be needed for that.
Thank you very much indeed for your time this afternoon. Ambassador Kurt Volker, who was a former US special representative for negotiations in Ukraine.
Now, Scott's very much on the fence, joining us from Virginia, USA. I will reiterate what a load of dingo's kidneys this 28-point Russian peace plan is. Is Witkoff a total moron or something? Jane and Fee at times.radio, 0333 003 2353 is our number this afternoon. Coming up, why children with trauma need to be parented differently. You're listening to Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wickes, the experts in kitchens and bathrooms.
The Times Radio Gender Debate with Jo Coburn.
There are so many medical and ethical questions around trans rights, women's rights, and the health and well-being of children who question their gender. Leading feminist Helen Joyce will debate all this with Helen Weberly, who facilitates hormone treatment for children and adults who want to change gender.
The Times Radio Gender Debate with Jo Coburn, tonight from 9 on Times Radio and live on the Times Radio YouTube channel.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18+ UK residents. Available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Visit Times Radio on YouTube for the latest videos and interviews.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms. Choose from thousands of products. Wickes have options to suit every budget. Plus, with great offers now on, it's the perfect time to start planning your new kitchen or bathroom. Find your nearest showroom at wickes.co.uk.
Now, yesterday evening, Jane and I found ourselves in a Wickes, the
we
one
did.
In Tottenham, in yeah. which is north London. We went to Seven Sisters Tube Station. We marched through the wind and we went to have a look at Wickes Kitchens and Bathrooms.
Yeah, we had a good time. An unexpectedly good time.
So they've got this little gadget there, haven't they? And by the way, we're not being paid extra to say this. We went and we had a really nice experience. They've got this little gadget that enables you to choose your door cabinet finish,
yeah.
plop a bit of worktop on
it. Worktoppery and your handle.
Yeah, and you and I did choose very different things, which is why we must never, ever live together. Do we do a podcast together?
Yes.
We spend a lot of time together. Recent topics on the podcast include being B-Day positive, manned petrol pumps, and who Gordon Bennett was. Did you find out who Gordon Bennett
no,
was?
No, I didn't.
Well, do you want to get on to it, sister? Our 3:30 interviews can be heard in full, including recently we've had Joanna Lumley, Young Chang and Peter James. And last week I spoke to Katie Prescott, technology business editor at The Times. Now, she's written a book looking at the life of the tech tycoon Mike Lynch, who died in 2024 when his yacht sank off the coast of Sicily. Coincidentally, hours earlier, his business partner, Stephen Chamberlain, was killed in a car accident. And Katie told us the coincidences didn't end there.
And the weekend itself is really odd because it was the 18th of August, which was the date that Hewlett-Packard had bought Autonomy and was forever known within Hewlett-Packard as 818, which is this sort of terrible day for the company. Mm. So it was extraordinarily strange.
It certainly was, but still, and it's a fantastic forensic piece of journalism that Katie has done on the life and times of Mike Lynch, and she says it really is nothing more than an extraordinary coincidence delivered by the universe. It's 21 minutes past 3. Children who've been in care are 10 times more likely to end up in prison. That's the statistic we told you on Tuesday when we covered the government's plans to try and turn things around. For that, we spoke to the former social worker turned best-selling crime author Anne Cleaves. She told us why children in care need much more support.
The children who are in care are probably the most troubled kids. They've grown up with trauma, with abuse, with addiction. They need much, much more input and help than any other child who's just going to school and rocking along quite happily. And my worry, I think, is that they don't get it, that we don't put enough money into the system right at the start, that we don't have more imaginative ways of dealing with troubled kids. And I'm not at all surprised by that statistic, because they've had such disturbed upbringing. They don't have the consistent care that we would love them to have.
Well, our next guest was listening to that on Tuesday and messaged us. Sarah Naish is a former social worker herself and is now the chief executive of the Centre of Excellence in Child Trauma. Sarah, how delightful to talk to you, and thank you very much indeed for messaging in. Just tell us a bit about what the centre focuses on.
Sure, yes. Hi, thanks for having me. So basically everything we've set up has been in relation to having the difficulties that I experienced with my children. I adopted 5 children. And even as a former social worker, it was only then that I realised that, you know, the children think very differently. We weren't trained to do that in my social work training at all. So I needed to put in place all the training, all the resources, everything we needed to help children who have suffered trauma.
Tell us a bit more about what you mean by these children actually thinking differently, their brains working differently because of their experience.
So the best way I can explain that is I always say, I use this analogy when I'm speaking, that imagine that my children were born on a plane. So my children, all siblings, all from one family, born on a plane, no seatbelts. And unfortunately, the birth parents are unskilled pilots. We don't know why. They just can't fly a plane. So during that time, the whole time, the children never experienced safety. There's lots of crash landings, lots of swooping and diving, never know when the meals are coming. There's no buffet service on the plane. And so their brains adapt to the environment they're in. The amygdala part of the brain, the base brain, the bit that gets us out of trouble, is bigger. And our children are wired for fear. So when we talk about our children not coping, it is that they are terrified. And too many people try to get the children off the plane, put them into another plane, an adopter, a foster parent, say, here you go, these people are fine, they're safe. Well, the children don't know what safe is. They don't know what a safe adult looks like. So they've got nothing to measure that with. So with my children, I couldn't just say to them, you're okay now. I had to land the plane safely hundreds and hundreds of times to show them that I could parent them. And that takes a long time. And we're literally rewiring the children's brain as we do that.
Why isn't that very clear message? And it's a brilliant analogy that I think makes us all understand better the things that you're talking about. So does that message of how to re-parent simply not get taught?
Well, we teach it. We do a lot of training and conferences. I've written a lot of books around it, which I'm very lucky. They've gone all around the world. And I see a big difference now to 15 years ago. But I think there's a feeling that it must be really expensive or really difficult to do, but it really isn't. Adapting your parenting doesn't cost very much money, and we do free trauma-informed training. So I think it's more of a mindset approach. People are very stuck in outdated ways of parenting, all around reward charts and timeout and naughty step and stuff like that. That just does not work for children from trauma. It just doesn't. If a child feels like I am a bad person, doing things that make them feel, you know, even worse doesn't repair anything, doesn't make any connection, doesn't change the behaviours. And that's why prison doesn't work either.
Sure. Can I just ask you a personal question? And of course, you don't have to answer it if you don't want to. But before you adopted your children, what kind of things were you taught? What kind of things were asked about how you imagined your parenting was going to be?
Well, of course, before I adopted, I was super nanny. You know, I'd done nursery nursing, and I knew all about the naughty step and reward charts, and I could look after lots of neurotypical children simultaneously, no problem at all. But luckily, I did foster when I was very young, and I thought, oh, this is a bit different. And then within 3 months of my children moving in with me that came home to me, that were adopted, I realised that everything I had ever relied on didn't work. And I literally had to, I always say my children taught me everything I know, literally. It is not taught in social work, not taught in universities. So I learned it from my children. I adapted my parenting to them to get them to adulthood safely. And that was a very steep learning curve, because at that point there weren't any books, there wasn't anybody talking about therapeutic parenting or trauma-informed parenting. It was just, oh, they're naughty children, they need to learn, they need to sit still, that kind of thing.
You mentioned the police there, and actually this new national protocol that the government is talking about, it is trying to focus on exactly that meeting of troubled children, troubled through no fault of their own, and the criminal justice system. And it does seem to be that it's taking on board some of what you're saying, that when the police meet these children, they have got to have a different way of working out why they have done something and therefore what the punishment might be. So it's a step in the right direction, isn't it?
It's a step in the right direction, as long as the police get the right training to become trauma-informed themselves, which, you know, would be a lovely idea. I have spoken to the judiciary about this, and I have done some training, but we haven't done any training with the police. And they need that training too, because, of course, there's that feeling of, oh, they're just getting away with it because they've been in foster care, because they're adopted or whatever. It's an excuse. But actually, it's not that the children can't have, or the young people can't have, consequences to their actions, because therapeutic parenting, you know, my children would describe me as strict but fair. There's definite boundaries. But it's about saying, if you do this, this will happen. This is the consequence for you. This is what comes back to you. But if we say, if it's not linked, for example, if we say, if you're rude to your teacher, then you'll get detention next Monday, I can assure you, no synapses are being built in that child's brain. No change is happening. So we are literally wasting our time. So when we lock up young people who haven't linked that cause and effect yet, we'd just be locking them up again in a year's time.
Is there a difference in the age at which you start applying a different method of parenting?
Well, the brain changes happen a lot, you know, at the age of 25. I noticed a lot of differences in my children, all young adults around that time, also between 13 and 15. But obviously, if you get a child younger, it's a bit easier. But it depends absolutely on the experiences they had. So, for example, as I said, my children all came from the same birth family. My children all work with me. They've written books with me, so they're comfortable about me speaking about it. So one of them had been there for 6 years and one was removed at birth. It doesn't mean necessarily that the one that had been there for 6 years is going to have more problems than the younger one, because all the children adapt differently. So it's about recognising those individual needs and perhaps inherited mental health difficulties, that kind of thing, and working individually with the children.
I know that you're on your way to Australia to give a series of lectures, but how involved are you in this country with changing the protocols around children in care?
Well, very involved. I've helped set up and run two not-for-profit therapeutic fostering agencies, so that keeps me very current. I've got a brilliant team. We have 98% stability. I'd be really surprised if any of those children went into prison. Really surprised, because they've all been therapeutically parented. Ofsted recognised that change. We do loads of training with local authorities, with schools. We've got our own trauma school that we help set up in Gloucestershire. So from the ground up, really, I do a lot of conferences with foster parents, adopters, kinship care. That's where all the books have been written as well. And we do everything we can. That is all my motivation, really, that nobody should feel the way that I felt when my children were young, which was, I'm alone in this, I'm being blamed and judged, people think you're getting it wrong, and you don't know where to turn. So we've always tried to be there to help other adopters, foster parents, parents of neurodivergent children, to understand they're not alone, there is something they can do, and actually that training is all there. We've got hundreds of hours online as well. So we're all not-for-profit, so we do whatever we can, and we go wherever we're needed. Yes, I am going to Australia, But, you know, last week I was in Worcestershire, just up the road, so that was easier to get to.
Good luck with the flight. So what a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you very much indeed for coming on the programme. That's Sarah Naish, and she is Chief Executive of the Centre of Excellence in Child Trauma. If you're interested in everything that she's been talking about, just pop that into a search engine. The right kind of stuff will come up.
Yeah, Nick says, what an awesome woman. Too true. Thank you for that, Nick. The origin of Gordon Bennett. Well, Alex says, I believe the Gordon Bennett phrase is from an Isle of Man TT races motorbiker. Jill says, in Menton in the south of France, the quay is named after Gordon Bennett. And artificial intelligence tells us that it's with reference to the controversial newspaper publisher James Gordon Bennett Jr. Apparently, he was a very strange chap and behaved in a mildly offensive manner at times. And a specific incident often cited is when he allegedly urinated into a fireplace at a formal party.
And that gets your key named after you. Is there no justice in the world?
We're still not really entirely certain where Gordon Bennett comes from. One thing I can tell you, the very dapper Tom Allen awaits the other side of the news headlines here on Times Radio. Just after 3:30, Tom Noonan has the latest.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Jane, thank you. Good afternoon. The Home Secretary says some legal migrants will have to wait up to 20 years to apply for permanent residency. Shabana Mahmood wants to raise the typical wait time from 5 to 10 years, but there are factors which can increase or decrease that time. For low-paid foreign workers who arrived in recent years and claim benefits, the wait would be 2 decades. The Conservative Shadow Home Secretary Chris Philps says they're all ideas from his own party.
So I am delighted, Madam Deputy Speaker, to see that the Shadow Home Secretary, upon arrival at number 2, Marsham Street, has got out the copy and paste function on her laptop and started copying and pasting Conservative policies.
The chair of the COVID inquiry is set to publish her second report in the next hour. Baroness Hallett will focus on decision-making in government during the pandemic. One of the country's most notorious sex offenders has been given his 37th life sentence. Former police officer David Carrick was found guilty of assaulting 2 more women, one when he was a teenager and she was just 12. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky will meet top US army officials in Kyiv this afternoon. It's after the US and Russia drew up their own peace plan, including the requirement for Ukraine to cede land and to halve the size of its army. And there are amber warnings for snow across some of North Yorkshire this afternoon. There are also less severe yellow warnings for snow and ice across much of the East Coast, Northern Scotland, Western Wales and the southeast of England. Don't forget, you can set the Times news briefing as your news service on Alexa.
This is Times Radio.
I'm Adam Vaughan, Environment Editor at The Times. And in Planet Hope, we meet the people tackling our biggest environmental and scientific challenges. From saving penguins in Patagonia to helping people with paralysis to move again. These are stories of science, courage, and hope. Follow Planet Hope wherever you get your podcasts. Planet Hope is brought to you by The Times in paid partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative.
Those who are curious feel an urge to travel, to explore the world. At Viking, we create voyages for the thinking person because travel enriches the mind and connects cultures in meaningful ways. With small, modern, all-veranda ocean ships that were designed to bring you closer to the destination, discover the world's iconic cities and quaint villages. Exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
Step inside our Hotel Chocolat cafes and experience the festive magic with our limited edition drinking chocolates crafted by our chocolatiers. Sink into the crisp, creamy notes of peppermint white or the delicate spices of mince pie. Topped with cocoa whip, the crowning glory. Light as air, intensely chocolatey. Oh, go on then. It is Christmas after all. Discover your new obsession. Only in Hotel Chocolat cafes.
Daryl Morris wraps up the weekend's news and takes a look at the week ahead, Saturday and Sunday from 10 p.m.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with Wix Kitchens. There's over 70 stunning styles to choose from and great offers too, including the Spend and Save with up to 50% off kitchen units. Terms and minimum spend apply. Find out more at wix.co.uk.
Tom Allen loves his garden. He's got hydrangeas and a new water feature, and he would like to share with you this happy, calm place in either a YouTube viewing or his new podcast series called Pottering. Hello, Tom.
Hello. How lovely to be here with you guys.
Well, it's very nice of you to come in. We were expecting you to be wearing one of those kind of Monty Don linen smocks. Maybe have a little trowel parked in your back pocket. Nice Labrador, but look at you.
Still same old me, lightly coloured suit, an orange tie, and not very practical for gardening. But I do know those sort of suits you mean, that kind of linen, deconstructed smock sort of suit. Yes, I don't know where you get those from.
Well, it looks like Windy Miller. You're not old enough to remember Windy Miller, are you?
Oh, that sounds familiar, though. Yeah.
He kept the windmill in Camberwick Green.
Oh!
And whenever I see Monty Don, I think of Windy Miller. Anyway, carry on. No, let's just stay on that for a while.
Oh, how nice. I'd like to be in a windmill like Mr. Majika.
Yes. Remember that? Yeah. Exactly. Can we take from that, it kind of explains where you are in your gardening journey, that you haven't decided to go and buy a whole wardrobe in which to garden.
Well, I do have a trug. I never know how to say that word. It's just a trug, okay. Well, I am early on. I'm very open about being a proud novice, and I enjoy gardening, and I'm very happy to just sort of show my failings in the garden in a bid to encourage other people to have a go as well. I think that's become a bit of a mission with me, just because I think everybody feels better for spending time outdoors. Mm. So I think in our fractured world...
Can we learn just a little bit about your own garden, and particularly your soil type?
Yes, that sort of thing. Grown-up gardeners talk a lot about ericaceous soil and things like that. Probably clay,
right? I want to say. So lends itself well to growing what?
Hydrangeas.
Beautiful. Thank God he didn't just say plants.
I'm one up from that. Grass seems to do well there.
Does it? Good.
I've been pretty pleased with everything. I've struggled with my Acer, though, this year, as I think a lot of people probably have. Mm-hmm. Mine got a bit scorched, and I think all the leaves went a bit crispy, like they'd been deep-fat fried. And then now it just sort of looks like a twig in the middle of the bed. But I'm not sure. People say it might come back. So I don't know, like Lazarus, maybe my Acer tree will come back. Mm.
Is it just simply not possible for you to ever say anything without it sounding like a double entendre?
I'm trying to think of a double entendre to respond with now, but I can't think of one. It's not possible, I'm afraid.
So let's just stick with it. Mm. Your connection to gardening, though, is quite a lovely one, because it's also a connection to your dad, isn't it?
Well, yes, my dad always liked growing vegetables, because he was a product of the Second World War, really. He was born in 1941, at a time when people, I think, did more... often grow their own vegetables, so whether it's potatoes or runner beans. So he kind of tried to impart that on me, and most of the time I didn't listen to him. And then when he died, I thought, oh, that would be a good thing to do, to sort of remember him. And also, I don't know if anybody here has found that, when you lose somebody, people go, oh, take time for yourself, take time to grieve. But in truth, there's not really any time to do that, is there? Because you have to go to work and you have to sort of get on with things. So the gardening stuff I've made time to do was sort of the only time I had to think. Mm.
Also, I think it's just incredibly useful to carry on doing things that that keep you busy, if you're doing something with your hands. Because you're absolutely right. Yes. People say, take some time out, don't come back to work. But you don't want to just sit in a house with your thoughts, do you?
No way.
It's the worst thing.
I don't want that at the best of times. Yeah. Never mind. At a sad time. So so being busy. And there's something great, actually, about getting your hands dirty, I realised. As somebody with, you know, quite, as you can imagine, quite soft hands. Well, moisturised hands. I'm never far away from a canister of hand cream. I like actually just doing things with my hands rather than a shovel or anything. I just like to scrap around in the mud. And there's something very pleasing about it, actually. It's supposed to be good for you, isn't it?
You have got a huge ornamental... It looks to me like a gigantic urn or trophy.
Thank you for noticing.
Yes, it is. It's huge, Tom. Mm. I mean, but I've only got the image in some publication called the Daily Telegraph, which is printed for. And
I didn't bring that with me.
No,
that with me here in a sort of protest.
You have that, do you, in the middle of your lawn? Just describe it.
I have an enormous urn in the middle of my lawn. There, I've said it. You can have that as an exclusive. And
why?
I bought it online and I did not measure how big it was, and I thought it would be a normal size, and it arrived. And you know what? We went on a tour of Buckingham Palace last year. Their urns Same size.
Okay, how big is it?
Well, I don't know. What do you want to have it in comparison with?
You.
It's bigger than me.
No, yes. Don't, it does look enormous.
It is enormous. And it sort of created a kind of... It makes the garden look a bit more like it's in Versailles, you know, or maybe that it's some sort of Parisian cemetery of some kind. That's the vibe it now has, okay. Rather than a polite suburban garden, which is what I started out with.
Right.
But when I first got it, and this is a good metaphor for life, isn't it? At first, I thought, this looks ridiculous. But as time's gone on, it's blended in quite perfectly.
I tell you what, Tom, you've got yourself a talking point, haven't you?
Well, that's the thing, and that's what you want. A lot of people seem to think it's where they say, have you got loved ones' ashes in that urn? And I think people maybe misunderstand, not to be morbid, yeah. on a grey November day, but that would be a lot of ashes. It would be a big person.
Your whole family.
Yeah,
all mixed up.
It would be.
Oh, let's not go there. No, let's not. So you're using gardening as a method to communicate with an awful lot of people because it's a podcast now, this gardening thing.
It is. I took my restful thing and I turned it into something stressful by making it...
And lucrative. That's
hugely lucrative, let me tell you. Absolutely. No, I did it because I wanted to do something that I did off my own back. And I think the online sphere does permit that. So I decided to invest in making something myself and just invited my friends in to have a chat in the garden. Sometimes they know a lot about gardening. Giovanna Fletcher was on the other day. She knows loads. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they know nothing. James Acaster, for example, is on this week's episode. Knows pretty much nothing.
But does it help to help the conversation along?
Well, that's what I found.
Right. Okay.
Being in nature, I think, is a good way to get to know people and to allow them to relax. And I think you get to, through the incidental conversations you have in a garden, sometimes you get the most insight, I found.
Hopefully not recording one at the moment, because the conversation would just consist of, I'm perishing, can I go in? I mean, that would be about as much as I'd contribute. Not that you've invited me on.
Well, you'd be very welcome to come on. Mm. But I know you're always busy, of course, doing this show. So,
yes, of course.
And also, you live over the other side of London, don't you?
Oh, I know. Don't give away where I live. It's extraordinarily exclusive.
I know that Mayfair townhouse is a long
Jane,
way
I hate
me.
To say it, but he doesn't want you on.
No, and busy. Also, I should
break
say
it to me
that
gently.
I don't want... But you like gardening, don't you?
No. I've got a visit from the people who maintain my garden, actually, first thing tomorrow morning.
Oh, that's exciting.
Well, it is, because it is such a mess at the moment, and I live in between two incredibly neat gardens in my street, where clearly the owners of those houses have spent quite a lot of money on making them look... Fabulous.
So are you letting the street down?
Well, I absolutely am. Plus, Tom, I've got artificial grass.
No, Jane,
no,
really?
I have a so's fee.
No fee.
I do. Yeah,
what's the point of being on Times Radio if you're going to do things like that?
Well, I'm looking...
It's nothing sacred in this country anymore.
I'm looking at proper turf. Now we've been here 4 years. I think we can just about afford it. Mm. But I tell you what, in a small town garden with a north-facing garden...
Oh, gosh.
There's no point trying a lawn. It just didn't work.
Well, what about a bit of gravel or something like that?
Gravel? Then, with
kids? Especially for the drainage.
No, absolutely not. I don't have enough money for the first aid that would be needed to have what were then toddlers and gravel. When we first moved in.
So what do you
this
do with
your... This is fascinating.
It is. Well, I imagine this
coming.
Is the sort of incidental thing that your listeners adore. But the maintenance of something like that, what do you do, hoover it?
Yeah, well, tomorrow, for example, my gardeners will get the big blower out and we'll just suck up all the leaves.
Please, don't start talking to me about euphemisms when you say things like that.
Well, I know, it's just a simple fact. It's not a euphemism. It's just what's going to happen in my back garden tomorrow morning.
Yeah. Well,
I have got rid of my AstroTurf now and I've replaced it with hard standing.
Oh, what's that?
Great big paving stones.
Well, that's better. I guess it's more of a natural material.
Well, I guess so. Look, I think
do you rake the leaves in? Do you have to rake the leaves in at all? Or do you...
I just did it. I just got a big, great big brush and then I tore a cardboard box in half. Because actually, picking up leaves with your hands, even with gloves on, is just so arduous.
It does take a bit of time.
But if you get two great big sides of a cardboard box, you can...
Oh, yeah.
Shoosh them in together. Yeah.
The thing is with leaves, though, people are quite afraid of them, but actually they mulch down quite quickly. I've learnt that. There's a lot of talk about mulching, I've learnt, amongst gardeners. And the thing is they mulch down quite quickly and it benefits the soil. And I think really the thing that everyone's going to get very excited about in the next few years is soil health. So I think it's good to have a few leaves to add to it.
Mm. Well, so the podcast is called Pottering.
Indeed.
Okay, and it's available now.
Mm.
I think we're going to move on now to other areas of your work, Tom.
Oh, I'd like that.
Were you asked to do Traitors, and are you keen to do the next Traitors?
No, I wasn't asked, and I would like to do it.
Who would you want to be, a traitor or a faithful?
I would probably like to be... probably a faithful, actually, because I think a traitor must be so such hard work. And I think that sort of hood really wouldn't suit me either. I'm walking around with a lantern. It's always...
Tricky. And the thing that I did love about this series was that people commented on the fact that you might be able to spot a traitor because they'd be knackered, because they have to stay up doing loads more filming that after everyone else has gone to bed.
I tell you what job I wouldn't like on the traitors is being responsible for marshalling them back without them seeing the other person.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, that must be quite arduous, I think. Like, to get them into their rooms without seeing anybody else, or knowing who's come back late because they've been up the tower.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean?
I do. I've got questions about traitors altogether, really.
Have you?
Well, because my issue with it all the way through was that I thought they were all savvy enough to realise that making Alan Carr a traitor would obviously be great television. So why didn't they... Were they just afraid to say it too early? Because if you go too soon, that destroys your chances.
Well, they're probably in the moment, aren't they? That's the thing, isn't it? They're probably in the moment so much, they didn't think to question anything. That's what I imagine. And I imagine it's quite tiring. That stuff where you have to do an activity.
Do the tasks.
You wouldn't do them?
I'll just stay at the castle and I'll have some tea and I'll see you for the round table. That would be my tactic.
Well, that might put them off booking you, therefore. But
I think it's because you devastated her with not booking her for pottering. She's now just saying she's not interested.
I didn't realise this would be so... I mean, to be honest, I've just asked a few friends to do it so far. So if you want to do it, you can.
Right.
I'd love to have you both down, in fact.
Can we also talk about Bake Off?
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So I've loved every single series and I love the spin-off that you do with Joe Brand. I think it is just fantastic.
Can I
be controversial and say, that I didn't think that this year's finalists were the right ones?
Oh, right. Okay, well, go on. Why did you think that? Big Tom, yes.
I didn't think he deserved to be in it, actually.
Wow, I hope he's not listening.
I mean, I thought he was totally and utterly style over substance. Did you?
To be honest, I've never met anybody who has such strong opinions. And I work on the after show of it. But I thought he was good. I thought he was consistent and hardworking. He did some very elaborate things.
I thought his things were beautiful. Mm. But when he did the great big... Sorry about this, Jane. Sorry to everybody who didn't see this. But when he did the great big enormous chocolate beehive and then just basically stuck some tuck biscuits on it that were meant to be macarons, I didn't think he deserved to go through, Tom.
That was a trying week, I think, for a lot of them, wasn't it? But I think... Yeah, but I didn't think it was enough to send him home. I thought it was probably a bit epic, wasn't it? It was probably a bit simplistic, just to sort of melt down some chocolate in the shape of a beehive. Yeah. But I didn't think that was a sending home, considering how well he'd done.
And when you do your Bake Off Extra Slice, and you've got this amazing microphone in the shape of a whisk.
Thank you for noticing.
Does that actually work, or is that just a
prop? It's real.
Is it real?
And we had it as a normal size whisk, and then we had the pandemic. And so we had to be 2 metres apart, so we had it on a big stick. And then and then after the pandemic, we just sort of kept it like that. So, you know, it's sort of a social distancing tool at one point.
And all of those lovely people who come along, they've all baked cakes. Oh. And they so... I mean, the whole room is basically just going, pick me, Tom, pick me,
They're
Tom.
They're delightful people.
How do you decide?
Well, we go with the people who've definitely brought a cake, and the people who've told us they're going to bring a cake, they are usually the first people we go to. And I must say as well, like, I'm always quite mean and quite, what's the word, cheeky with them, but they are, they're always very lovely people. And they, you know, they come along with these cakes that tell, like, a whole story about how they went on holiday and got food poisoning and then fell in a lake and all these things. And it's quite elaborate for, you know, a bit of fondant icing. But that's kind of what's lovely about it, actually, trying and sort of learning about people through their cakes, I think, is quite an interesting exercise.
The whole spin-off of a show is relatively new, isn't it? I know The Apprentice has a spin-off.
Yes.
Bake Off has a spin-off.
Yes. Traitors has a spin-off.
I mean, could there be a spin-off from a spin-off?
I'd like to think so. And if there is, I'd like to present it.
Okay.
Yes, I think it's a sort of moment to reflect. I think with a lot of those television programmes, what's amazing about them is that there's still a point when people sit down as a family and watch something. So I think Traitors is a great example, Bake Off, Apprentice, Strictly. Families still sit down and watch those things, and they're a conduit to conversation. So I think the after show just sort of helps with that a bit.
Well, you said the word Strictly, which of course means...
Oh,
well, why
that?
Not you, Tom?
Oh, I would love to do Strictly. The thing is, I think that staircase at the beginning, I'd fall down. I think it's very stressful.
Sweet, but you could practice.
What, coming up and down the stairs?
Yeah, I mean, I know you couldn't... I mean, if it's live, it's live. Mm. But you could just learn during rehearsals to do it adroitly.
Well, you have a lot of faith in me, Jane. I don't know. I don't. I mean, I'd like the idea of it. Also, it's a big commitment, isn't it? It's a big commitment to get all those dance steps. You've got to be very good at it.
No, I mean, I want you to host it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Don't waste
your dance.
Oh,
okay, I'll do it. I'd love to do that because I've always loved Bruce Forsyth.
Well, I mean, I'm going to say that there are, and please, I hope this isn't offensive. But,
no, I don't think it will be.
Well, no,
it's bound to be.
It's not. There are similarities. You have that variety show persona.
Oh.
Anchorman.
Oh.
You're Mr. Saturday Night.
Oh,
I think, Tom, I think you've got it.
Oh, Jane, I'm glad I came in now.
No, I mean it.
Well, that's very generous of you to say. I always loved Bruce Forsyth when I was a kid and loved his sort of all-rounder show busyness.
Yeah.
And loved the
I think you'd be brilliant because also you bring an element of humour. That, you know, the double act that has been Claudia and Tess has been absolutely amazing, and how fantastic, apart from anything else, to have two gorgeous women.
Absolutely.
You didn't need the man and the twirly bird anymore.
No.
But it has felt quite scripted, hasn't it? And I think Claudia does a good job when she's interviewing all of the contestants and stuff, but I would love to see you go a bit rogue on the floor.
Well, I think they've done a magnificent job with it, but I think it'll be fun. It'll be fun to do something like that. I mean, just the glitz of it. And I think people do like camp glitz, don't they? They like a bit of, you know, bright lights and spangly costumes and people just doing something that sort of takes you out of yourself. Yeah. I think there's something lovely about dance in that way. I mean, I've always loved Fred Astaire, but that's probably no surprise to you.
Mm, it isn't a surprise, but honestly, I think you're being a little cagey, and it wouldn't be at all surprising to me if you were, you'd already been involved in negotiations.
Oh, that's very cool. Well, you're welcome to look through my emails.
Who are the hot favourites at the moment? You've always got your eye on the bookies, do you know?
Well, there was some talk about Paddy McGuinness doing it, but I don't think so. No, thank you. No, thank you.
Gosh, said like a true Points of View writer in.
Well, funny you should mention that. I was a regular on Points of View.
Yes, I think I knew that. Does it still run?
No.
That's the sort of programme I quite like to do.
Yeah.
People moaning. It's quite...
I don't think the BBC needs it at the moment, Tom. You could actually do with a period of tranquility. Tom Allen would be the man I would effortlessly shoehorn into Strictly, and there would be no controversy whatsoever.
Well, I'll go and buff my dancing shoes.
Right.
On that basis.
Okay. If people want to hear a little bit more of you on the radio, you're available in this building.
Yes.
You're right at the top of the Tower of Power, aren't you?
Absolutely. At the seat of power on Virgin Radio, 10 till 1 on Sunday mornings. We have a nice time there. It's largely me playing rock music to... women called Jan and
Oh, Jan Lynn. Listens to us as well.
Don't be rude about Jan. We'd be nowhere without her.
My life has been built on performing to people called Jan.
Okay.
Trish, a few Trishes probably.
Okay, so, do you have Tracy from Cambridgeshire? I love Tracy
No,
from
I banned her.
Did you? Oh, she's one of our most enthusiastic supporters.
Well, Tracy, you'd be very welcome. Yeah, you'd be very welcome.
No, don't nick our listeners.
Well, we have a nice time on there, and then and Pottering comes out every Thursday, and I do it as a visualised podcast, and I do it as an audio podcast, so you can either listen to it whilst you're doing other tasks. I don't tell you what tasks you do. It might be some light dusting or something like that, or taking the dog for a walk, and then you can watch it if you like to see what we're up to, and if you want to see the garden as well. But I try and make it audio-wise and visual-wise a calming space, so we try and include the sounds from the garden to give people a bit of peace and quiet, even if they're having a stressful day.
Lovely. Thank you, Tom.
Thank you.
Errol thinks we're middle class and clueless. Thank you, Errol.
I love it, though.
Well, we are. We're certainly middle class. Mm. Let's just own it. Mm. And Phil says...
Not many Errols left in the world, are there?
There should be more. Phil says, I once slept in the room in which the New York heir, Gordon Bennett, died. It was at his villa, Namuna. I'm a pretty dull chap, so I trot out this fact from time to time for my interlocutors to marvel at. Wow.
That's an interesting fact.
And Chris says, Gordon Bennett is a corruption of God in heaven or God in Himmel. It's used to avoid offence in mixed company.
Sorry, I realise you're talking about something you did before I came to the studio.
We actually have content before you arrived. Yeah, don't worry, Tom.
I should have been listening, but I was actually enjoying the shelves outside in the waiting area, which are completely empty. Have you thought about putting some plants on there?
Which shelves?
The shelves in the waiting room around there. Oh, completely empty. And I thought, well, that's a wasted opportunity. You could have a few books or something.
I know. It's an area of consternation in the building, that, because it falls between two programme teams.
Oh, OK.
We've got our eye on it.
I think it would suit you.
Yep. So there's a talk TV team and there'll be a fight.
Yes, I'd like that. Yeah. Oh, that'll take you back to your BBC days.
Certainly will. I've still got the biceps to prove it. Tom Allen, it's been lovely. Thank you very much indeed.
Very grateful. Thank you.
It's Jane and Fee on Times Radio with Wix. Book your free design appointment at wix.co.uk.
Rod Little on Times Radio with M&G Advice. Listen every Saturday morning from 10 as he takes on the biggest topics of the week and engages with leading voices from politics, culture and beyond, changing the conversation and reframing the discussion in no uncertain terms. Rod Little, Saturday mornings from 10 on Times Radio with M&G Advice. Approaching retirement? Get the advice you need in no uncertain terms from M&G Advice. Authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority.
Listen to Times Radio on your DAB digital radio.
Here's the truth about AI. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. ServiceNow puts AI to work for people across your business, removing friction and frustration for your employees, supercharging productivity for your developers, providing intelligent tools for your service agents to make customers happier. All built into a single platform you can use right now. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. Visit servicenow.com/UK/AI for people.
For people living with dementia, Christmas can be confusing, overwhelming, heartbreaking. Families are often left to cope alone. But you can help a family reimagine Christmas. Donate to Alzheimer's Society and you can help provide practical support, expert advice and crucial companionship this Christmas. It will take a society to beat dementia. And we can't do it without you. Search Alzheimer's Society and donate today.
Chase is the digital bank that could boost your savings.
Ooh, tell me more.
When you join Chase, you could earn 4.5% AER variable. That includes a 2% AER fixed boost for 12 months on top of our standard saver rate.
Oh, yeah, nice.
Yep, our savings boost could help you reach your goals, like that once-in-a-lifetime adventure. Get our best easy access saver offer today. Search Chase Boosted Saver. Offer may be withdrawn at any time. 18+ UK residents. Available to new current account customers for your first 31 days. Eligibility applies. 4.41% gross. Terms apply.
Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
Kate says, I love that you two are prepared to express opinions. Kate, I hope you listen to Off Air with Jane and Fee, the podcast, the moderately successful podcast that we do Monday to Thursday. Every edition will come your way around about 6:30, Monday to Thursday.
And it's all opinion. There's no fact at all.
It's just opinions. I mean, it's absolutely, it's raving opinions. Tracy loved her mention as well, Fee.
Oh, well, we love you, Tracy, so keep listening to us. Don't go and join Tom Allen.
And Glyn says, every time I see Paddy McGuinness on television, I think there's somewhere a branch of Iceland is missing its deputy manager. Yes, all right,
Glyn. We love Glyn as well. Thank you for your company this afternoon. We're back on Monday at 2. Our producer today was Felix Forbes. Our technical operator was, and hopefully always will be, Ryan Boyden. Up next, it is John Pienaar with Drive. Stay with Times Radio. Enjoy your evening.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio, the voice of the times.
Thank you, Fee. Thank you, Jane. At 4 o'clock, I'm John Pienaar. This is Times Radio Drive, and here are the headlines. Shabana Mahmood has set out plans to make migrants who arrived after Brexit wait 20 years to get settled status. And Volodymyr Zelensky is due to meet US military officials after American and Russian governments agreed a peace proposal. And coming up, we're going to be hearing from the chair of the COVID inquiry, Baroness Hallett, as she delivers their latest findings on how the government made decisions during the pandemic. And you can hear my interview with the man who was once responsible for the CIA, General David Petraeus. What does he make of the US making a peace plan for Ukraine with Russian officials?
This is Times Radio.
And other news with Tom Noonan.
Good afternoon, John. Thank you.
Some legal migrants will now have to wait 20 years before they can apply for permanent residency in the UK. The Home Secretary wants to double the baseline wait time for legal migrants from 5 to 10 years. However, Shabana Mahmood says there will be a consultation on making that wait even longer in some cases.
The government proposes that those who have received benefits for less than 12 months would not qualify for settlement until 15 years after arrival. For those who have claimed benefits for more than 12 months, that would rise to 20 years. To encourage the use of legal routes into this country, those who arrive illegally could see settlement take up to 30 years.
There are proposals for some people not to wait a decade, though. For example, teachers and NHS doctors and nurses will still wait 5 years, and those earning more than £125,000 could qualify after just 3 years. The chair of the COVID inquiry is due to release her second report in the next hour. Baroness Hallett's expected to focus on decision-making in Boris Johnson's government, and you'll be able to hear some of her press conference on Times Radio Drive. One of the UK's most notorious sex offenders, the former police officer David Carrick, has been handed an additional life sentence for molesting a 12-year-old girl and raping a former partner. It's his 37th life sentence. The 50-year-old is already serving at least 32 years behind bars for 71 other crimes. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky is due to meet US military officials after the American and Russian governments agreed a peace proposal. The 28-point plan, agreed with the Kremlin by Donald Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff, would see Ukraine give up all of its Donetsk and Luhansk regions and halve the size of its army. Security specialist and Times columnist Ed Lucas doesn't think the plan will ever come to pass, though.
To conduct a really successful sort of geopolitical shift like this would require very sustained attention and officials of a sort of Henry Kissinger type effectiveness, and I don't see that in the administration. So I suspect that this is just another dead end.
It's reported the Prime Minister's planning to make a trip to China in the new year. It's believed Sir Keir Starmer will make the journey at the end of January. This week, MI5 warned of persistent Chinese efforts to spy on Parliament. Asda is selling off some of its supermarkets to raise money. 24 stores have been bought by two sellers. Asda will now lease them back so they can continue operating as normal. And on the eve of the first Ashes test, stand-in Australia captain Steve Smith has launched a bizarre attack on former England spinner Monty Panesar. Panesar recently suggested that England players should needle Smith on the field about his role in the ball-tampering Sandpapergate scandal 7 years ago. This was how Smith responded.
Who of you in the room has seen Mastermind and Monty Panesar on that? Any of you? Yeah. Well, those of you who have, you'll understand where I'm coming from. And those of you who haven't, do yourself a favour, because it's pretty comical. Anyone that believes that Athens is in Germany and America is a city, doesn't really bother me, those comments.
The first Ashes test in Perth starts tonight at 2:30 in the morning UK time. For a news bulletin, when you want it, to search for the Times News Briefing podcast.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
John Pienaar on Times Radio Drive with IG.
Hello, I'm John Pienaar with Times Radio Drive. It is good to have your company. It almost feels like a bad dream, doesn't it? Except that over 200,000 people died in the UK by 2023, COVID. And in a few minutes, live here on the programme, you'll hear the culmination of the inquiry into the political decisions, the emergency measures, the costly mistakes, the lockdowns and the scandalous lockdown-busting parties in Downing Street. It is a truly important moment, so do stay with me. And we'll hear the words in a moment of the inquiry chair, Baroness Heather Hallett, setting out her verdicts on the way that the pandemic was handled. And it is a fair bet. Her report, her words, were maybe hard for some of the decision takers to hear. Now, the report, a solid, solid report, is now in the process of being released. And some lines are beginning to come out, just beginning to come out. Among them, 23,000 people who died could have been saved. British governments during the pandemic failed to appreciate the threat. The response, according to the COVID inquiry report, amounted to too little and too late. And there will be very much more of that very, very soon. Let's just recap on how we got to this point, the point of hearing the detail of this two-year inquiry, investigation and report. I'm going to be talking later to the Times Health editor, Eleanor Hayward, by the way, who has had sight of the full report. She is going to be joining us and helping guiding us through its essential and sharpest points. Now, the chair of this inquiry is, of course, Baroness Hallett. The report looks at the political choices that were made at the time, including the lockdowns, how they were introduced, the closure of the businesses, the schools, the social restrictions. You might remember Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, at the time of the pandemic, apologising.
Can I just say how glad I am to be at this inquiry and how sorry I am for the pain and the loss and the suffering that I understand the feelings of these victims and their families, and I am deeply sorry for the pain and the loss and the suffering of those victims.
That was Boris Johnson. You may remember those words. He admitted mistakes were made.
So many people suffered, so many people lost their lives. Inevitably, in the course of trying to handle a very, very difficult pandemic in which we had to balance appalling harms on either side of the decision, we may have made mistakes.
And you will, of course, remember Dominic Cummings, who was at Boris Johnson's side in No. 10 Downing Street. He, of course, gave his contribution to the evidence and discussed the thought process as the crisis unfolded.
The PM at the time would refer to the Mayor of Jaws from the film, who wanted to keep the beaches open. I think he had a routine from previous in his career where he would use that as a joke from one of his sort of after dinner speeches. But he sort of said, you know, there's more harm coming. The mayor was right all along to keep the beaches open, because it would have been a long term harm to the community.
Dominic Cummings there, just a part of the enormous volume of evidence that led into this inquiry, into this report, which is now being summed up by its chair, Baroness Hallett. Let's cross live to that.
It assesses whether those decisions were reasonable and made on the best available information. Most importantly, it considers whether the appalling loss of life from the COVID-19 virus and the devastating socio-economic consequences